This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
With an eye on the happenings on the other side of the world, of course, our program today is the state of this economy right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 26th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. How about a scorecard of sorts with which to begin today? A tally, if you will, of where things stand in this economy long about the fourth week of August.
So the economy is in a very good place, not quite back to the pre-pandemic level, but we're close.
All right, that's good. Economist Ioana Marinescu is at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Social Policy and Practice, and she speaks there of this morning's revised report on economic growth. GDP is the indicator with which you will be familiar. It ticked up to 6.6% for the second quarter, annualized, of course. However,
So the growth cannot continue, not at the 6.5%, because it was coming from the fact that there was a big growth deficit. We were coming from really low. And so a lot of the growth is catch up. And when there's catch up, it can't go on.
Also, and not for nothing, we got first time claims for unemployment benefits today. They went up just a bit, 353,000. Still really low, though, compared to where we were. But this, Professor Marinescu points out, is where the virus is still kind of in charge of this economy.
The uncertainty associated with Delta is going to put a damper on employers' willingness to add more workers. We think about places like restaurants, people might be less willing to go out, and that then lowers business and lowers hiring.
The August monthly unemployment report comes out a week from tomorrow. Remember, though, it is a lagging indicator. Ioana Marinescu at the University of Pennsylvania. They're giving Mitchell Hartman a day off from the Marketplace desk of Economic Peril. We will hear from Mitchell later, though. Come tomorrow, it's consumer spending data from the Commerce Department, but a couple of earnings reports out this week, Dick's Sporting Goods and Best Buy among them, showed how the pandemic has been good for a lot of retailers who've capitalized on consumer preferences for more efficient, that is to say, easier for them ways of shopping. Things like shipping direct from the store or curbside pickup. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
When Christine Donnelly first decided to try curbside pickup in the D.C. area during the pandemic, the idea felt a little cringy, you know, like sending a personal shopper off to do her bidding while she waited in the car looking at her phone.
She's like, I hope I don't come off like some privileged queen.
But before too long, she was using the service to pick up craft supplies at Michael's, Tupperware organizers from the Container Store. She even did a curbside return of shoes at Nordstrom.
I am a person who does not like to shop in the store. So for me, it was a great option.
She hopes stores will continue to offer it after the pandemic. And there's reason to think they will, says retail consultant Joel Rampolt at Alex Partners.
Curbside pickup is a great win because the retailer doesn't have to deliver all the way to the consumer's home.
And it allows retailers to multitask with brick-and-mortar spaces and employees, says Chelsea Gross, an analyst with Gartner.
It's most efficient to leverage your physical stores. They can actually manage both the online orders from the fulfillment center as well as the in-store shop with kind of this endless supply.
Plus, the convenience for customers makes curbside competitive with traditional e-commerce, says Forrester analyst Sucharita Kadali.
I think what they've discovered is that they've actually brought share back from companies like Amazon because the customer experience is actually delightful when, you know, you can just drive up to a store, they bring whatever you want out, and you get it super fast.
That, of course, assumes curbside purchases are substituting for online deliveries rather than in-store shopping, which is the most cost-efficient since customers pick their own products and deliver them home. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This is going to sound callous, cynical, maybe, but you would be hard-pressed to find a hint of what's been happening in Afghanistan by looking at Wall Street. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Here's today's non-economic indicator. According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, which is from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and a couple of other agencies, 98% of the American West is officially in drought, 60% of it in extreme drought. And that's why members of Congress and governors of 10 Western states are asking President Biden to issue a major disaster declaration out here. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
In 30 years of ranching in the Sierra foothills in California, Dan Makin says he's never seen it this dry.
As a consequence, we have a lot higher expenses in terms of feed purchases and hauling water to livestock and those types of things.
A lot of ranchers Makin works with through the University of California Cooperative Extension are selling cattle and sheep because it didn't rain or snow much this winter. And now there's not enough grass for them to eat or water for them to drink. This is happening all across the West and as far east as North Dakota.
It's certainly an agricultural disaster.
Daniel Sumner is a professor of agricultural economics at the University of California, Davis. He says a federal disaster declaration could free up funds to help ranchers ship cattle further east where there is grass for them to graze on.
Or it may be the case, here's the funds you need to bring in loads of alfalfa hay from somewhere where they don't have a drought and ship it in. And that's not something that a ranch could seriously consider. They just don't have the money for it.
But with climate change making drought more common and more extreme,
the word Band-Aid is very apropos here.
Melissa Ho focuses on freshwater and food issues at the World Wildlife Fund U.S. She says a federal disaster declaration is critical right now.
We really have to think of how we stabilize the short-term situation so that we can really understand how to address the more systemic issues given this new future and the fact that the new future is now.
The infrastructure package currently making its way through Congress includes about $8 billion in funding for water and drought-related projects. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Five words, gang. David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. Check it out. We talked yesterday about the Biden administration's plan to hire more people in cybersecurity. Good reason for that, too, because there has been a lot of news of hacks and attacks on businesses and industries, many of them what are known as supply chain attacks. So we got Dr. Sheetal Fechty on the phone. She's from the University of Richmond, where she studies, among other things, risk management. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I think we need to start with the definition of terms. When we say supply chain attacks, it's not things in trucks getting delivered, right? That's not what we're talking about.
Right. We're not necessarily talking about items that are moving across the country, but we're talking generally about the cybersecurity and the information systems that fuel these supply chains.
Give me an example, because there have been oh so many of them lately.
Yeah. So a supply chain attack can basically turn the information technology, for example, the computers and the software, they can be disrupted. And when the computer, the software, when they don't work, then we can't move items from coast to coast on those trucks.
SolarWinds, right? That was a supply chain attack?
Yes, it was. And in particular, because it affected the ability for not only goods and services to move, but also for transactions to happen. So for the sale of services.
Right. Now, why are they becoming or have they long been a preferred method of entry, a vector, if you will, for these cyber criminals?
Well, it's becoming more and more prevalent today because systems are becoming increasingly interdependent on one another. So what that means is a disruption on one system or one piece of software can have disruptions across all interconnected softwares, ones that basically share data or communicate with one another.
Am I right in remembering that at least in the recent ones, they can go undetected for quite a while?
Yes, absolutely. What attackers do is they tend to burrow into the system, gain information, and choose to attack or choose to become visible when they are ready, often on their terms, often in cases when they are ready to, for example, ask for ransom.
So if I'm running a company and I'm the head of IT, what do I do?
Well, there is a lot IT can do and a lot it cannot do. So, for example, when there are potential entryways into a cyber system, those are called vulnerabilities. And vulnerabilities often become known. And when they are known, they can be patched. So a company can patch the vulnerability and ensure, at least to some extent, that they have sealed the entryway into their system. But the company may not be aware of the vulnerability. And that is one of the most dangerous situations that is really coming into play more recently.
Okay, so not to personalize this at all, but I'm smack in the middle of what seems like interminable IT security training here at Marketplace. Mm-hmm. Is this an individual level thing?
It absolutely can be. So you as a user of email may often get phishing emails in which maybe you get an email with a suspicious link in it. And in an organization, in a company, those types of emails may go out to hundreds, thousands of employees. And it may take just a single employee clicking a bad link to create an entryway for attackers to get into the information systems.
What about you? You're a professional. Do you have to do this stuff too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My university just started a system in which external emails get a yellow band across the email telling me that it came from an external party.
We just got that here as well. I guess it's everybody.
Yes.
Dr. Sheetal Fechty at the University of Richmond. Thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm going to get a call from IT now. I know it. Coming up.
Teaching behind the scenes is really hard.
Hard in front of the scenes, too, I bet. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 192 points today, about 0.5%, 35,213. The NASDAQ dropped 96 points, about 0.6%, 14,945. S&P 500 off 26, about 0.5% there as well, 44.70. Cloud-based software company Salesforce floated up 2.6% today on better-than-expected second-quarter earnings and forward guidance. Cloud storage firm NetApp grew 4.7%. IBM, just plain old IBM, drifted down about 0.7%. The discount retailer Dollar Tree tumbled 12% today. Second-quarter earnings beat estimates, but revenue went the other way. Dollar General dropped 3.7% today. Bond prices down just a bit. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note remains at 1.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There's some data out from the Census Bureau this week that shows a recent decrease in both hunger and poverty for households in this economy with kids. That matches up neatly with the families that are getting those expanded and advanced child tax credit payments, as much as $300 per child that started in July, if you remember that. And they are, by the way, set to expire at the end of the year. As Marketplace's Amanda Peacher reports, some households have felt the difference those payments make, more than others have.
The American Rescue Plan, which passed in March, expanded the child tax credit and allowed families to receive direct cash deposits. And that influx of cash has been especially helpful for very low-income Black and Latinx families. Eric Rodriguez is with the nonprofit Unidos US.
We could see significant poverty reduction in the Latino community, as much as 40% of Latino kids.
Susana Salgado's children could be among those. She and her husband work, but still struggle to make ends meet for their family of four in Chicago. Her husband works at a restaurant, and his hours were cut recently because of the Delta variant. Salgado put the monthly deposit toward back-to-school expenses.
So we're buying backpacks, uniforms, school supplies, and also paying for the registration for programs that our children want to participate in that sometimes are not free and we have to pay.
The benefits affect white families, too. In Denver, Heidi Larson is a single mom who works in the hotel industry. The credit helped her pay for childcare for her 8-year-old son.
It couldn't have come at a better time.
Larson hopes the cash payments and increased credit will become permanent.
This child tax credit takes some of that stress that I was feeling about how am I going to do this? How am I going to keep going?
Extending the direct cash payments for households with kids is part of the Democrats' $3.5 trillion budget bill making its way through Congress. And once people experience these kinds of benefits, they're more likely to become permanent, says Catherine Mitchell Moore, public policy professor at the University of Michigan.
Once these changes happen in the tax code, they tend to stick because they tend to be fairly popular among the populations.
But whether the program continues depends on whether it's also popular with lawmakers on the Hill. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
Economic equity in this country is more promise than practice, as Amanda was just talking about. And that extends to the labor market, too, of course, where more often than not, people of color just can't get the jobs that'll get them into the middle class. Our case in point today, manufacturing, where demand for workers is high and growing. The pay is good, but opportunities for Black and Latino Americans are slim. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what's going on there.
Here's what we're talking about. The 7 skilled machine tool operators who make furniture and park benches and entry gates at Diseños Ornamental Iron in Detroit's Mexican town. Owner Nieves Longorda walked me through the plant by Zoom.
So right now I'm inside the metal shop. The grinders are going in the welding as well.
The company is plenty busy and can handle the volume of work now, but
a lot of my guys are aging out, and it's hard to find youth or younger generations to come in and fill their spots. So that's really where I'm struggling.
Longordo says schools no longer teach vocational programs, so the mostly Black and Latinx young people who live in the neighborhood aren't prepared for jobs with manufacturers like her who want to stay in the neighborhood.
We told our youth, go to school, get an education, get an office job. And now, as a result, there's a shortage.
But where there are training and apprentice programs, there's plenty of opportunity. Back in 2012, I visited an advanced manufacturing vocational high school on Chicago's west side.
Drawing here. All right, guys, let's put your work back in your folders.
Rakeem Buford graduated from the program that year.
They taught us CNC machines, engineering, different measurement tools, programming, safety codes, and they helped us get credentials.
Also, interviews and jobs. Buford's now 27. He's worked as a machinist at 3 manufacturing plants, been a union shop steward, gotten steady raises.
When I started working in 2012, I was making $11. Now I make $23 an hour.
Buford works for a nonprofit called Manufacturing Renaissance to recruit other young people into manufacturing, and that also includes his own family. A lot of them work for the post office.
Yeah, this is new territory for people in my family. I do like that I got into it, though, because my younger cousins, I'm able to tell them about another successful way they can possibly choose in life.
The industry coordinator for Manufacturing Renaissance, Dee Dee Jones, says she can get high school grads hired at well above minimum wage with vacation and retirement benefits, on-the-job training. The challenge is convincing them it's even worth considering.
The younger folks are looking for mission-driven companies. They want to make a difference in their careers. Different than just going to work to get a check to provide for the family.
Another hurdle becomes evident every time Stephen Tucker takes a group of high school kids into a local manufacturing company. He runs a workforce training program in Buffalo, New York, and he says most of the students are black and brown, while most of the workers they see are
older white men. Right now, people of color in production jobs is less than 20%. And for women, it's less than 5%.
Tucker says the business owners and managers they have to network with, mostly older white men, too.
We are now placing students of color in companies where they are the only ones working in that company that looks like them. And that can be very intimidating.
Tucker says companies need to promote more people of color and women up the ranks. Banks and community lenders need to help them become owners. Nieves Longordo in Detroit says it's also up to business owners like her to minimize structural barriers to employment.
There's limitations for people of color, and I try to accommodate whether it's language or transportation, being a single parent and needing more flexibility.
Longordo hopes that'll help her attract and retain younger workers of color who can end up making upwards of $50,000 a year in her shop, more than twice the median income in the city of Detroit. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Depending on where you are, school's either been back for a while now or is going to get going real soon. But either way, this back-to-school season is unlike any we've ever seen. Masks, sometimes. Remote options, sometimes. Testing, sometimes. Stressful all the time for students and their parents, and for teachers, too, who've been at the center of all this for the past year and a half. That, then, is the setup for today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Catherine Fink, and I'm a high school English teacher and a first-year law student in Longmont, Colorado. You know, I went into teaching because teachers were the happiest people I knew. They were so kind and generous and loving and gave me so much. And, you know, come to find out when you're actually a teacher that a lot of teaching behind the scenes is really hard and can be really draining, and the burnout factor is real. I love teaching, and I really think that if it was more financially rewarding, I might stay in it. You know, I hate saying that. I don't want to be the kind of person who just thinks about money, but with three kids to put through college and just to survive in today's world, like, I just wish that people respected teachers enough to pay us what we're worth. One of the wonderful things about teaching is the summers, right? So while the kids were at summer camp, I would study for the LSAT, and I took it once and did okay, but I really wanted to apply for a scholarship. So I actually got a tutor to help me get two more points, but I got it and I got the scholarship, so I think it was worth it. If I just kind of look at the numbers, we're still going to be short about $1,000 a month. So that's rough, but I'm going to do the student loan thing again. And, you know, the kids are offering to have a lemonade stand. I don't know. My son wants to sell the origami that he makes. Everybody's pitching in. So I think we'll be okay. It's pretty phenomenal that I live where this program exists. Basically, you do all asynchronous work during the week, and then two weekends a month, you go on campus and do in-person classes. So my goal right now is to get up at 5 and exercise, get ready for the school day, teach, and then use my planning periods to do all my schoolwork at school, which I've never accomplished before, but I'm bound and determined to do it this year, so that when I go home, I can put in a couple of hours of law school work before the kids get home. I think the hardest thing for me is kind of letting go at home and not being the organizer of everything and just trusting life will go on without me at home. But I also think it's really good, especially for young kids, to see their mom pursuing her passions and
hopefully they will look back and realize that, you know, although we had time where we were missing each other or we were apart or I wasn't there to, you know, share those experiences, that I'm someone they can be proud of and look up to.
Catherine Fink, teaching high school English and going to law school in Longmont, Colorado. You know, this series only works with your help, so do let us know what's going on in your personal economy, would you? There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, Man Bites Dog edition. You know Zoom, the company whose product we've all been using way too much the past 18 months working from home? Well, you know who's going to be Zooming less? People who work for Zoom. The company announced a new hybrid work plan this week, part home, part office, no firm schedule, but still amusing, I thought. All right, we're out, but here is your moment of economic context. Do with this what you will, but I noticed this morning the TSA throughput numbers, how many people are flying commercially, have started to sag just a bit. Only 1.5 million people flew yesterday. That is the lowest since the first week of June. Amir Bibawi and John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.